Good day and welcome to Letters on Politics. I'm Mitch Jezrich. Over the past 2,000 years, no name has been so reviled as that of Judas Iscariot, one of the original 12 apostles who informed Roman guards of the whereabouts of Jesus. The act would lead to the arrest of Jesus and to his crucifixion. In the early years of the New Testament, there was a great factional fight within nascent Christianity over how the story of Judas would be told. Those who wanted to condemn him, like Pope Leo the Great, the first all-powerful pope in the Christian world, won out and would use the name Judas synonymously with that of betrayal, and Judas would be used as a religious and literary scapegoat for acts of anti-Semitism for centuries to come. But there is another view of Judas that also comes from old ancient Christian texts that never made it into the New Testament. Texts from a mystical branch of the religion, who today we call Gnostics, who portray Judas as the highest of the apostles, who knew what needed to be done in order for the all-so-important crucifixion to happen, an apostle who Jesus trusted the most to carry it out. To talk about this history, I'm joined by Peter Stanford. Peter Stanford is the author of the book Judas, the Most Hated Name in History. Peter Stanford is also a journalist. He writes for the Daily Telegraph, and he is also a broadcaster on the BBC. He joins us from London via Skype. Peter Stanford, it's my good pleasure to welcome you to this program.
Lovely to be here.
I want to begin by talking about a place, and that is Hakodama. What is Hakodama, and where is it?
Hakodama is a very barren hillside just outside the old city of Jerusalem, to the south of the old city of Jerusalem. And it is the place that Christians have always associated with the site where Judas hangs himself in Matthew's Gospel. There are two accounts of Judas's death in the New Testament. The first is in Matthew's Gospel, where we're told that he hangs himself in a field, which south of Jerusalem, which is taken to be Hakodama. And a slightly more explicit account in the Acts of the Apostles, where it talks about Judas having used the 30 pieces of silver that he gets for betraying Christ to buy what is called a potter's field, a field of clay. Potters obviously using clay, so a very clay field, which was called the field of blood. And the word Hakodama is the Aramaic for a field of blood, Hakodama.
And you visited this place?
I visited this place. It's very odd. I mean, there you are in Jerusalem, which is the old city of Jerusalem, tightly packed. Every single corner of it is a pilgrim site. Every building tells you that something from the Gospels or the New Testament happened there. And then suddenly, right next to it, is this just completely bleak, empty hillside. The top bit of it is used as a rubbish dump, actually, I discovered when I wandered around it. And in the middle of it is a very small Greek Orthodox monastery with only two elderly nuns left in it. And this is meant to be the place where we have not remembered, in the sense that people don't really remember Judas with any great fondness. But this is the spot that marked where Judas is meant to have hanged himself. And what we do know from travellers' accounts, right back to the 3rd and 4th century, is that this was the spot where people came and remembered Judas, and didn't remember him in a happy way, but remembered him, remembered his example. So you would go on your pilgrimage to Jerusalem, and you'd go to the Garden of Gethsemane, you'd go to the spot where Christ died in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, you'd follow the Via Dolorosa through the centre of the Old Town, and then you would also go to Hakodama to remember Judas. And I suppose you remembered him in the sense that you didn't want to be like him. He's a terrible warning to us. Here was the man who was the most, well, you know, in Jesus's most intimate circle of these 12 people who knew him best, and still he betrayed him. So it was almost a place where you went to feel bad about yourself.
Hakodama, again, the place where the New Testament says Judas Iscariot committed suicide. The term translated from Aramaic is fields of blood. Did it get its name because of Judas' suicide?
No, it's hard to know. I mean, initially in the Acts of the Apostles, it says that it was just a potter's field, and it became known as the Field of Blood because, well, There are two very different accounts in the New Testament. There is the account in Matthew's Gospel of Judas Iscariot hanging himself, which in a way is the one that we all know. And if you look at Christian imagery, particularly in the Middle Ages, there is Judas hanging from a rope. That's the image we all know. But actually, the Acts of the Apostles, which comes after Matthew's Gospel, comes 20 or 30 years after Matthew's Gospel, tells a slightly different story. And what happens, it's right at the very beginning of the Acts of the Apostles, is after Jesus has died, risen from the dead and ascended into heaven, and Peter gathers the apostles together and says, look, we have there are only 11 of us left because this terrible Judas figure has died. And then Peter describes the way in which Judas has died, and he describes it in a different way from Matthew. He says that Judas used the 30 pieces of silver that he'd been given by the chief priests and the Pharisees for betraying Jesus, to buy this piece of land. The potter's field, a clay field, and that he was went there to sort of in a way enjoy his ill-gotten gains. But because he was so evil, because he'd done such a terrible thing, his body literally swelled up. It was almost as if the devil possessed him inside, and he burst asunder, is the phrase that's used in the Acts of the Apostles. So Judas's innards literally burst open. It was as if the devil inside him was bursting out and splattered onto the ground in this potter's field. And it was the sort of innards bursting onto the ground and the blood and the things that would be caused there because of that meant it was called the field of blood. So it is Judas's blood. That is why it's called the field of blood. It's not Jesus's blood.
There are two different accounts of how he killed himself.
That's right.
Are there different accounts on how he... And we'll talk about this word betray, but we'll just use it for now. And we've talked about the suicide. Maybe we should go to what he's most known for, betraying Jesus. Or are there different accounts at how he did that?
Each of the different Gospels, so there are four Gospels, and each of them tells a different story. But let's go back to the very beginning, really, of Jesus's, the accounts of Jesus' life. So what you have in the New Testament, most Christians will be familiar with this, is you have the four Gospels, and then you go on to the letters of St. Paul. Now, that isn't the chronological order. The very first documents that we have about Jesus's life are St. Paul's letters. St. Paul wrote his letters between 50 and 60. AD or CE, whatever you want to call it. So they were the first documents. Now, in Paul's letters, what does it say? He tells us about Jesus' trial, his death, and his resurrection. And he simply says that Jesus was betrayed. He doesn't tell us who the betrayer was. He simply says he was betrayed. And why doesn't he bother telling us who the betrayer was? He doesn't tell us because it doesn't really matter. The important thing about Jesus is that he dies and rises from the dead. That is the basis of Christianity. That is what Paul was concerned about. And indeed, in those accounts in Paul's letters, what you also get is in the account of Jesus rising from the dead on the third day, he rises from the dead and is greeted by his 12 apostles. There's no suggestion that Judas isn't there. There's no suggestion that Judas has been excluded because he's done something terrible. So they were written around 50-60 AD, and then you move on to the Gospel accounts. The Gospel accounts come afterwards, even though in the book order of the New Testament, they come first. And the first account of the Gospels, in the Gospels, the earliest Gospel, is Mark's Gospel, which was written around 65-70 AD. And Mark simply says that when he describes the betrayal, that Judas, he gives no explanation at all. He simply says that Judas went to the chief priests and said, I'll betray Jesus. That's all it says. No suggestion of what the motive is. Fast forward about 10 years and you get to Matthew's Gospel, which was written about 80 AD. And Matthew gives Judas a motive. He says that Judas did it because he wanted the money. He wanted the 30 pieces of silver. And it's only in Matthew's Gospel you get the 30 pieces of silver. Fast forward another 10 years and you get to Luke's Gospel. Luke doesn't mention greed at all. Luke says that the reason Judas did it, the reason he betrayed Jesus, was because he was possessed by the devil. It was the devil that made him do it. And then fast forward about 20 years to the final Gospel of the four, John's Gospel, written between, we think, about 110, 120 AD. And John has it four ways, really. Not only does he tell us that Judas was greedy, and he describes him as the treasurer, really, of the Jesus movement. He kept the purse and he stole money from it, saves his feet. But he also says that he was possessed by the devil. So they all give him very, very different motivations.
Understanding, as you point out, the Bible was not written all at once. Many different writings that are in there over time, over decades. But it sounds like with each writing, as it goes along with time, it portrays Judas as being worse and worse.
Yes, and the Christian ideal has always been to make Judas the worst of all people, really. So you see that process going on through the Gospels, that in a sense he becomes an uglier and uglier character. And of course, 2,000 years on, what we tend to remember is the collection of all those categories, those qualities. We don't remember which gospel they're in. We just remember we have a sort of composite picture. And then if you move forward from the Gospels through those early Christian documents that were written, in each of those, each of them almost wants to paint, almost vies with each other to paint Judas as a worse and worse person. They attribute all sorts of terrible things to him. And I suppose the most important thing to note in that context is that from very early on, because Christianity grew out of Judaism, but around 60 AD, and we have that's there in the Acts of the Apostles, there was a great meeting that took place in Jerusalem where the two factions of what one might at that stage call the Jesus movement. I keep getting tripping over Judas and Jesus. They're such similar names, but anyway. they've got virtually the same letters. It's a tricky one to talk about. But anyway, so you have this meeting in AD 60, there in the Acts of the Apostles, of the Jesus movement. And they have to decide, effectively, whether they're going to be a Jewish reform movement, and there's a group that want that, or whether they want to be what Paul and Peter and the Apostles want, a church for everybody. And they decide to be a church for everybody. Now, when you want to split away from your mother organization, all of us, when we move away from home, we want to put a bit of distance between ourselves and our mother in that sense. So the new Christian church wanted to put a bit of distance between itself and the Jews. It wanted to show itself as different. So what does it do? It starts sort of attacking and criticizing the Jews, in a sense, for not recognizing Jesus as the Messiah. So it wants to make them very different. And how does it do that? It does it by painting Judas as the archetypal Jew. And it does that in all sorts of different ways. I mean, the most obvious one is just in the name, Judas. So Judas in Hebrew is Yehudi, like the very famous violinist Yehudi Menuhin, and the word for Jew in Hebrew is Yehuda. So Judas became the archetypal Jew, and of course the archetypal Jew in the gospel stories betrays Jesus. So Jews are not to be trusted. That is the message of Judas. So Judas is used in all those Christian documents that go forward to the medieval period as an instrument of anti-Semitism. He is part of Christian anti-Semitism, a really ugly part of Christian anti-Semitism. So what you see in dotted all around Europe in medieval churches and cathedrals, you'll see depictions of Judas betraying Jesus, and Judas is always given all the characteristics that the Christian painters of the medieval period would give to Jews. So they'd be dressed in yellow, which was the colour that Jews had to wear because they were outsiders. He would always have a very large nose because Jews are meant to have very large noses. I've got lots of Jewish friends who don't have large noses. I'm a nice Catholic boy and I've got an enormous nose. But anyway, in the medieval time, that's what they thought, that Jews had big noses. So Judas is always presented as the Jew. And indeed, you can take that much further forward. If you go forward to the 20th century, to the Holocaust, to the Nazi attempts to vilify the Jews, what did they do? They kept associating Judas with the Jews. So Judas was the traitor in the midst of the Jesus movement, and Jesus is in a circle.
Were the Nazis trying to stir up a religious sentiment among people?
Well, you have to be very careful with the Nazis because there's a temptation to present the Nazis as in their persecution of the Jews as just continuing a Christian tradition of anti-Semitism. The Nazis themselves weren't particularly Christian. They were much more kind of pagan in lots of their ideas. But they absolutely exploited that Christian anti-Semitism around Judas. So in Nazi propaganda, and you see it in Yad Vashem, the Holocaust Memorial Museum in Jerusalem, You see Nazi propaganda sort of saying all Jews are like Judas. They're all traitors. We mustn't trust any of them. So they used that image. So that image of Judas as the betrayer, as the archetypal Jew, the betrayer, goes right through from those early gospel stories through the Christian medieval period and right onto the 20th century.
There's also the what's called the Dreyfus Affair that occurred in the late 1800s in France. Alfred Dreyfus, who was a military officer who was accused of a crime he did not commit. Tell me that connection to Judas.
Okay, so late 19th century, 1890s, the French Third Republic had just been defeated by the Germans in the Franco-Prussian War. France was in tatters. And the suggestion was that that someone had been leaking French military secrets to the Germans. And they looked around for someone to blame, and they blamed this man called Alfred Dreyfus, Captain Alfred Dreyfus. A huge show trial went on, and he was blamed for this. Now, he was Jewish, and it turns out he was secular Jewish. He'd never set foot in a synagogue in his life. But such was the virulent level of anti-Semitism, particularly from the right wing, the Christian right wing in France at the time, that throughout his trial, in all the... It was a huge thing in newspapers. Zola wrote a very famous pamphlet about it. He was never called Captain Alfred Dreyfus. He was always called Captain Judas Dreyfus. So, again, conflation of the idea of the Jewish betrayer in your midst with Judas, the betrayer in Jesus's midst. So that image resonates on and on and on through history. And actually, you know, I think, I mean, in a religious sense, I don't think we certainly don't do that anymore, I think. The vast majority of Christians, and I'm a Catholic, but I certainly think in a cultural way we still associate Judas with the betrayer. And one of the stories that I tell in the book is in about I think it was in about 2012, 2013, Rolling Stone magazine did a big retrospective interview with Bob Dylan, who at one stage in the mid 1960s had famously been called Judas by some of his fans because he changed from an acoustic guitar to using an electric guitar, and they saw this as a great betrayal. And there was an infamous concert where a whole group of people stood up and called him Judas, and he got very cross about this. And 50 years on, 2012, in this interview with Rolling Stone magazine, Bob Dylan said, "Can you imagine? All I'd done was change from one guitar to another, and they called me Judas, the most hated name in history," which, of course, is why I've used it as a subtitle for the book. But, you know, the name Judas, I think it shows you that the name Judas still has the power to wound people. If somebody calls us a Judas, we know they don't like us. We know they're not being nice to us. We know that it is a wounding word. It is an attack on us. And so that image goes all the way through from the Gospels, all the way through to the present day. We all know what Judas means. If someone says you're a Judas, they're not wanting to be our best friend.
We are in conversation with Peter Stanford. He is the author of the book Judas, the Most Hated Name in History. He joins us from London via Skype. Peter Stanford, let's dive back into history again then and look more at this development of the of what we know as Judas today. Let's talk about the forming of the New Testament. Again, this is a collection of writings. Many writings around that time did not make it into the New Testament. Tell me about the factional fighting that occurred in creating the New Testament and early Christianity and what happened with the story of Judas in it.
So you have the four gospel accounts, Matthew, Mark, Luke and John, which did make it into the New Testament. The reason they made it into the New Testament really is because they are the earliest of the four. There's only one that's earlier than the Gospel of Thomas, which is a collection of sayings really that are there in the other one. So they're there really because they were the earliest accounts. But thereafter, after those gospels, there's a whole series of other gospels written for the next 500 or 600 years. Every time someone had a sort of polemical point to make, they would often do it in the form of writing a different version of Jesus's life, reinterpreting Jesus's life in a way. And they would, in order to give them authenticity, they would often call them after characters from the official Gospels. You'd have the Gospel of Peter, you'd have the Gospel of Mary Magdalene, you'd have the Gospel of all sorts of people. I mean, you also have the Gospel of Judas. So in 2006, I think it was, National Geographic made a great global storm, really, by rediscovering this 3rd century version in Coptic, ancient Egyptian language, of the Gospel of Judas. And the suggestion really at the time was that it was giving you a different version of Judas's story, that somehow this was the real story of Judas, that his story had otherwise been buried. But I think you have to see it in the context, as I've just explained, that these were polemical documents. So the Gospel of Judas, this 3rd century document, was written by a group of early Christians called the Gnostics. And sorry, this all gets very complicated. I'll try and make it as simple as possible. But you had all these different factions in early Christianity. So you had what is called the Apostolic Church, which was the main church, the mainstream church, which kind of went on to, you know, popes and Rome and official churches and whatever. You had that, and then you had the different factions who disagreed with it. One of the factions that disagreed with it were the Gnostics. They said that Christianity shouldn't be about going to Mass and going to the sacraments. It should be about having a kind of mystical knowledge of Jesus. It was all about knowledge. So when they decided they were going to attack mainstream Christianity, which is based on the apostles, they wanted to attack the apostles. So what the Gospel of Judas does is it inverts the story that we know from the official Gospels, i.e. that the apostles were the good ones and Judas was the bad one. So in the Gospel of Judas, Judas becomes the good one who has this very special bond with Jesus, and the apostles all become, well, not exactly bad, but rather stupid. So what the Gospel of Judas opens with is this scene where the apostles are all sitting round celebrating the Eucharist with bread and wine in the traditional Christian way, and Jesus turns to Judas and says, oh, for goodness sake, did they not really understand what I wanted them to do? I didn't want them to go through all these rituals, to do all this fuss about bread and wine and body and blood. I wanted them to have mystical knowledge of me like you do. You know me best, Judas. So effectively what the Gospel of Judas is a polemical tract to attack the official church. That's what's going on there. It isn't an alternative biography.
The idea behind that is Jesus already knew Judas was going to play the role that he did, and it was an important part of ultimate salvation.
Well, of course he did, because if you are a Christian, what you believe is that God sent his son, Jesus, to earth to redeem our sins. This was all part of God's plan. This is something God did. And since God is omnipotent, i.e. all-powerful, again, in mainstream Christian belief, he knows what is going to happen. So he knew what was going to happen to Jesus. And he knew that part of that, what was going to happen to Jesus, was that he was betrayed. In that sense, Judas is doing God's work. He's not doing, as Luke's Gospel and John's Gospel suggest, the devil's work. He can only be doing God's work. And indeed, it is there in the Gospels. So in Matthew's Gospel, at the time of the Garden of Gethsemane, which is where Judas infamously kisses Jesus when the Roman soldiers come to betray him, Jesus turns to Judas and says, what you're going to do, do it quickly. I'm slightly paraphrasing, but it's effectively what he says. What you're going to do, do it quickly, i.e., Jesus knew exactly what Judas was going to do. So Judas was part of God's plan. He wasn't the devil's instrument.
Does the New Testament work out how we're supposed to feel about Judas, or what the lesson is that Judas represents? What happens to his soul after death?
Well, we're meant to hate Judas. That's what the New Testament is saying. That here is this man who knows Jesus so well and yet still betrays him. And I suppose, you know, stories, and I'm not saying the Gospels are stories. I think they are. There's elements of strong elements of history there. But any sort of narrative works very well if you can juxtapose different positions. So I suppose what you get in the Gospel is the juxtaposition of the Judas betrayal and the Peter betrayal. So, you know, those who know their Gospels well will know that when Jesus was arrested, Peter was standing outside in the courtyard where Jesus was being tried, and three times people came up to him and said, but you're one of Jesus's followers, aren't you? And Peter denies him and says, I didn't know him at all, I had nothing to do with me. And then the cock crows twice. So Peter betrays Judas, betrays Jesus as well, but Peter's betrayal is somehow redeemed. redeemed because he feels remorse for it, and he gets to be the Pope, and he gets to be have the keys to the kingdom of heaven. But Judas, his betrayal, he doesn't show any remorse, is the official Christian line on all of this, and dies a terrible death and is consigned to hell and will be there forever. That is the traditional Christian take. That's what we're meant to take from the Gospels. But think about it, really. I think one of the reasons I wrote the book was, growing up as a Catholic, every Easter you'd go and listen to the Gospels being read of Jesus's life and trial and death. And the character of Judas, that image of Judas hanging from the end of a rope in a lonely field, always struck me very powerfully. And it seems to me that by taking his own life, in a way, Judas was showing his remorse. He was showing his shame for what he'd done. It was his attempt to somehow kind of pay a debt. So it seems to me that Judas, it seems a bit unfair to confine Judas to hell. And of course, what is the Christian message? What does Jesus tell us in the Gospels? He tells us that all sins are forgivable, that through God's love, through Jesus's sacrifice on the cross, all our sins can be redeemed. So why not Judas's as well?
Getting back to the Gnostics again, this way of looking at it that is based on Jesus already knowing the role that Judas had to play, a necessary role that Judas had to play. Did Judas understand the role he had to play?
Hard to know, really, isn't it? The Gospels don't give us any insight at all into that, and they give us different motives for why he did it. There is no, I suppose, the only sense of self-knowledge that Judas might have, and this is actually a really important moment in Matthew's Gospel, and again, tends to be overlooked by mainstream Christianity, that what Judas does after Jesus has been arrested, after he's betrayed him in the Garden of Gethsemane, is he goes back to the temple, to the chief priests and the Pharisees, and he tries to give them back the 30 pieces of silver. So, you know, those of us who've got children, I've got children, we know when my children did something wrong, if they took one of their friend's toys, what do you make them do? You make them take the toy back and say sorry. And it's, if you read the Gospels that way, that is what Judas is doing. He's trying to atone for something that he's done that is wrong. And the chief priests and the Pharisees won't take the 30 pieces of silver. So he ends up throwing them on the floor of the temple, and that's when he goes off and hangs himself. So there's a sense in which Judas feels profound remorse, even in the Gospel accounts, that he feels shame for what he's done.
Peter Stanford, who then in history did it benefit to have so much hatred towards Judas? And I guess one person that immediately comes to mind after preparing for our conversation is Pope Leo I.
Who called him the wickedest man who ever lived, yeah. There was a
lot. I don't know how I came up with that one, but
no, very good. Very good prompt. Yes, he did. It was funny, actually, because with the books published by Counterpoint in America, and they have given it the subtitle "The Most Hated Man in History," which, as I've explained, is a line from Bob Dylan. I was slightly tempted to use that line from Pope Leo the Great, the wickedest man who ever lived. But I suppose when you start thinking about that, and we used a different subtitle here in England, you start thinking, was he really the wickedest man who ever lived? I mean, there are plenty of wicked people in human history. You might think about Stalin and the millions that he put to death. You might think about Hitler and the 6 million people who died there. You might think of Osama bin Laden. You might think of any number of people. And then you think about what Judas did. And if you examine those accounts in the Gospels, as I've said already, there's a degree of remorse for what he did. There's a degree of him paying a price for what he did that was self-inflicted, not inflicted from outside. Christianity has always held up the apostles and in a broader sense, the saints of the Christian church as role models for us. And I suppose what we're meant to do, because Peter did betray Jesus 3 times before the cock crowed twice, we're meant to think that Peter was flawed too. And so we're all like Peter. But I mean, Peter's flaws are pretty small in many ways. Off he goes then to be the Pope and have the keys sticking in him. And I've always thought, or it seems to me anyway, and perhaps this is saying something really awful about myself, but anyway, I'm going to say it. It always seems to me that in terms of flawed humanity, Judas is the apostle who speaks most loudly to me. He's the one who seems much more like us. And it seems that rather than damn Judas as the worst person ever, we might also think of him as someone who speaks to our own failings and flaws, and someone who feels rather human when you're listening to his gospel accounts.
Looking a little closer at Pope Leo the First, also known as Leo the Great, I guess his papacy went from 440 to 461. My understanding is, well, the reason why he's called Leo the Great is because he's the one that made that position as powerful as it would become.
Yes, he was intent on building up the office of the Pope to give the Pope not just the authority as Bishop of Rome, which he'd previously had, but also a much more universal jurisdiction. So he was, in a way... you know, one of the ways in which you assert your power is to get people to follow you, and one of the ways in which you get people to follow you, to listen to what you say, to obey your teaching, is to tell them that if they don't obey your teaching, terrible things will happen to them. And so, in a way, Judas becomes is so focused upon by Pope Leo as a really bad example. It's almost like if you don't follow the Christian path, if you don't follow the teaching of the church, if you don't do what Jesus told you, as we, the church, the institutional church, interpret it for you, you'll go the way of Judas. You'll do something terrible, you'll be seduced by the devil, and you'll end up in hell. So the bad example of Judas becomes an instrument of control in the early medieval, it's even before early medieval, isn't it, Leo? But that certainly goes through to the medieval church, and you see the power of a bad example was almost as powerful as a good example.
To achieve a certain level of power, scapegoating, having a scapegoat is an effective tool to have.
Yes, someone to blame, Judas is the person who is blamed for the death of Jesus. But of course, you know, as we've said already, Jesus's death and resurrection was part of God's plan. So if we're going to blame anyone for Jesus's death, we should blame God, not Judas. But Judas was blamed for the betrayal, and in blaming him for that, it then becomes part of this Christian anti-Semitism. If you blame Judas, you can scapegoat anyone who is like Judas. And so what that means, certainly in medieval Europe, is you can scapegoat the Jews. But it went kind of wider than that as well. It went initially in Italy. We have the rise of sort of capitalism in Italy in the 11th and 12th century in the towns of northern Italy, where the bankers there, because often in Germany, the bankers and the moneylenders would be from Jewish families, so again the link then with Judas was much closer. But in early medieval Italy, with the rise of capitalism, bankers were all good Catholics, but still you see them associated with Judas, because, you know, with the rise of early capitalism, people didn't like it. It was changing the world that they knew. They opposed it. They thought bankers, as indeed we still think now, are rich and greedy, and so they wanted someone to blame. And there in the gospel story is Judas walking around with his 30 pieces of silver, avariciously gathering money to himself. So in a sense, he becomes a way of scapegoating bankers. He becomes a scapegoat for bankers, for money people, for the money economy. And of course, one of the great debates of medieval Christianity was around usury, the charging of interest, and how you shouldn't really do that, how that was all sinful. So again, Judas plays a useful function in all of that.
Peter Stanford, you are also the author of the book The Devil, A Biography and How to Read a Graveyard. Is there a connection with the biblical devil and Judas?
Well, Judas was always seen as the devil's agent on earth, really, or the devil's agent amongst the apostles. And I suppose
that's what the New Testament says?
Yes, Luke's gospel says that the reason Judas betrayed Jesus was because the devil put him up to it. And there's an element of that also in John's gospel. So what you have in John's gospel at the Last Supper, where the first ever Eucharist, where Jesus, uses the bread and wine to symbolize his body and blood. In John's gospel, as Jesus hands Judas the sop of bread, it says in the gospel, and it was in that moment that Satan entered him, that the devil entered him. So Judas is very much the devil's agent, and that is the way that he has been betrayed. So the link is very clear between the two of them. And I suppose, you know, sometimes when people say, why do you write different books? One of the ways in which one book springs from another is that when you're researching one subject, and when I was writing the book about the devil, which came out, I think, in 1998, and I made a big television documentary about it over a television series about it over here in Britain, you start thinking about the other people and the role they play in the story, and Judas plays a pretty prominent role in that story. And I thought, in a few years' time, when I want to come back to this subject, I'm going to come back to Judas because he's very linked with the devil. So there is a connection between the two.
You have sympathies for Judas.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that this different viewing of Judas is ever possible by the church itself, the Catholic Church?
There are people within the church who look at Judas rather more sympathetically. There's the Pope in St. Peter's in Rome. There is a papal preacher. There's someone who's appointed every year to be papal preacher, or for several years. And the current holder of the post is a priest called Father Cantalmessa, which is a rather lovely name. It means in Italian, sing the mass. And Ranieri, I think he's called Ranieri Cantalmessa. And about two or three years ago, in his Good Friday sermon, so one of the roles that the papal preacher has to do is to preach the sermon in St. Peter's Basilica on Good Friday, he gave a sermon all about Judas, where he was quite nice about him and said, there's lots we have to learn. So I'm not the only person saying this. I just think Judas has basically got a pretty bad press in Christianity over 2,000 years, and he is a much more fascinating, a much more human, a much more approachable character that we ought to think more about and think about why he did it. And actually, by reflecting on him, we might learn something about ourselves.
Peter Stanford, thank you very much.
A pleasure. Thank you very much. Good to talk to you.
Again, the name of the book is Judas, the Most Hated Name in History.